What was called manna in the Old Testament is the literal manifestation, dropping like snow, from the bosom of the heavenly realm, and as it falls it covers those beautiful and mossy fibers, and slowly becomes like the purest honey distilled from the depths of the upper air. The beautiful substance is made from this manna are in all possible forms and shape, and each form and shape possesses a flavor and an odor of its own. Out of the one substance all forms and varieties of food are made, an art in chemistry which men will discover in this world on of these future golden days. For be it remembered that the immense riches of an apple are not yet known, much less those of a peach or a berry. Mankind are but just learning to preserve their fruits and common berries. When we get where aerial emanations are granted for food, and spiritual particles that float in the invisible ether amid the heavens, then we shall live the life of the lilies. The spirit world is thus brought into our actual experience, and the very life of it is seen and realized. Many of these visions of things would require most delicate descriptions to make them acceptable to the common sense of the world. But I tell you that the existence of the Summerland is not more mysterious than the formation and existence of a man's body out of the invisible life of his nerves. You may not see the philosophy of what I have here uttered, but it is as positive as science and is as literally true as that 2 × 5 = 10. And I fully believe that the existence and actualities of the next sphere will become a part of science, and that its philosophy will be as plain as the existence of such planets as Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Next headline, Society in the Summerland. That was not first which is spiritual, but the natural, afterwards the spiritual. If you will permit a little autobiography, I will again refer to my own past. There are persons who, I think, know nothing of my personal investigations with respect to the existence, circumstances, and scenes, of mankind's future life. They have only heard. Those who do know, will, I trust, excuse me for speaking to those who do not know concerning my personal relations to this subject. It is known and it can be demonstrated. The witnesses are nearly all living in this world, that this subject of the future life came upon me years ago. I stand before you educated, to some extent, by that advent. It has made me acquainted with questions which are not common to merchants, and men who work, and think, and have their whole being parallel with society, and with the laws of ordinary business enterprises. The realities and scenes of the future came to me more silently and gradually than the flower unfolds from its earliest germinal beginnings. There was no shock in the advent. I was very much of a child in mind and body, and in years also, when the spirit world was first opened to my vision. So far as I myself was conscious, it came without any preparations, without any expectation, without any theory whatever, and without any imagination with reference to what man's future state was, and would be. And not only so, but I was for years shut out from any external memory or other acquaintance with the wondrous facts that were delighting and intellectually enchanting the witnesses who were present when these things were delivered at 252 Spring Street, New York, in the winter and spring of 1847. Footnote, see Introduction to Nature's Divine Relations. Now, if I stood before you as an intellectual speculator, a theorist, as a person who had predetermined to wrest historical facts, to twist them, to mold them, to fashion them by the legerdemain of an anti-conscientious intellect, and by the force of imagination shape my facts to suit a foregone conclusion, then indeed I should not be for one moment worthy your respectful attention. Because, in such case, I should be an imaginationist and a perjured witness, self-condemned, and I could not longer speak. The words of my native tongue would cleave to the roof of my mouth, and I should be internally forced to breathe in the midst of self-consternations, and I know no power that could extricate me from the terrible embarrassment that would overwhelm my whole soul. But I do not stand before you in any such capacity. I am not a theorist, not an imaginationist, not a lawyer. My position is that of a person, who, without forethought or intellectual preparation, became slowly acquainted with realities and scenes that were transmitted, or impressed, day by day, from a higher sphere, until 2 whole years had transpired, and then, at the end of those 2 years, by a blessed mental unfolding, which only the spiritual metaphysicians can truly explain to your understanding, the beautiful memories which had been thus gradually deposited within me came out and stood in the foreground, and said, "Rememberest thou these things?" Instantly my external life, with its memories, was blended and married sweetly at the altar of the superior condition. So well do I remember it. In the city of beautiful Poughkeepsie, vividly, indeed, like a conscious flower, pulsated the clear facts of that new birth. And I stand before you as one who has continued these sublime investigations every forenoon, whenever my physical and external conditions were favorable for an entire cerebral abstraction, by which the physical world is shut out, and the spiritual senses opened, and then pictures and scenes of immortal beauty have been painted on the spirit's retina, such limpid realities as no pencil can possibly imitate on canvas, nor poetry transfer in language, to the mind of man. I appear before you, not as testifying in support of a theory, but to relate what I have seen as literal celestial verities. No theory can long exist which does not walk in the track of these indubitable facts. Nor can any philosophy long stand unless it comes to you just as these celestial facts came to me, in a logical sequence, following like flowing water along the unchangeable channels of cause and effect. Pardoning so much self-history, you will, I think, allow me now to ask your attention briefly to a philosophical basis for what I shall relate. In the year 1850 I began a chapter by asking the question, "Is human nature immortal?" The same question is before me now. Who is the infidel among you? Christians, are you who profess to believe so much better and finer and truer things than I do, you who pan current in the outward world for being orthodox in your persuasion, I ask you, is immortality a part of your conviction? If it is not, then some other method, and some stouter proof, will be necessary to implant it in your judgment. But if it is, then I ask you, is immortality possible except on the supposition that you are to continue forever to be yourself? Is human nature, the individuality, to be changed in the twinkling of an eye? Can your personal nature be supernaturally changed and converted into something different 10 minutes after death, or at the moment of the resurrection? Can such a metempsychosis take place and you still continue to be yourself? What kind of an immortality is that? For you, James and Mary, to be immortal, it is immutably necessary that you should continue to be James and Mary, and not others. When your neighbors, relatives, and intimate acquaintances arrive beyond the grave, they must be to you, and to themselves, the continuation of the individual life chapters here commenced to be written, otherwise they are utter strangers to each other, in all logical effects they would be new persons, and thus the doctrine of immortality would be nothing, although individuals might forever dwell in the higher realms. If immortality be a truth, then Christians cannot with reason say to me that I am uttering one word contrary to the divine system of the celestial, spiritual, and physical universe. If they repudiate immortality, then I am the Christian, that is, the believer. I do not wish to arrogate the former term, for, as the so-styled Christian world now goes, I do not think the name is either much of a compliment or recommendation. The doctrine of immortality is in the world's religious faith. If it be accepted by the intellect, it must be on the principle that mankind continue the life begun in this world. How can a man be after death what he was on earth, unless he be distinguished by the same structure, unless the same general mental conformation continues, unless he remains possessed of the same general physique, and the same general arrangement of faculties and dispositions of temperament, which give him individuality and a marked personal position with reference to others in this world? This reasoning I take as the first layer of basis, which may render the idea of immortality somewhat philosophical. Again I ask you who are openly avowed deists, I mean those Unitarian Christians who believe in God, whether, if there be a God, who, as they sky, is without variableness or shadow of turning, is he to be, or appear to be, an entirely different person or power in another state of being? Can an omnipotent, unchangeable, deathless deity be something entirely different when mankind ascend beyond the present, dearer to God? You know that deity, in the world's theologic conception, is a perfect, single man, large, vast, beyond all measurement, yet a man. And that the emanation from his Holy Spirit goes out to fill, and thrill, and vivify the illimitable spaces of the universe. This last diffusion of the Holy Spirit is what some Christians call the divine proceeding, the omnipresence, of the Spirit of God, taking the name of the Holy Ghost. Now I ask you whether, in your honest opinion, it be possible for an unchangeable God to change his nature and his balance. If he does not, it being intrinsically impossible, then would it not be natural and reasonable to suppose that another existence adapted to mankind would be simply another section, or a higher degree, of the existence begun here? Is it not logical to believe that what is primary here would correspond to something primary there, that what is here meant by justice, and truth, and liberty, would there be represented by something exactly the same, perfectly identical? If things begin here with roots and grow to summits, then, God not changing, and the vegetative laws and systems being the same, would you not suppose that all future growths occur in harmony with the inspiring principle? Otherwise, with a different philosophy, you are all afloat. You can have no common sense in matters of religion, unless you take the basis which is here given. It gives solid, fertile soil, and strong, firm roots to all your ultimate reasonings and contemplations. You send your children to the primary schools. What for? So that when they are old enough to take a higher position in the scale of learning, they may be prepared to take all their rudiments of thought up into a more practical mental development. For this end the primary schools are established, and that is why you consent to send your children to them. Now, what is this earth? It is a primary school. It is primary in the physical as in the spiritual, just as much in the social as in the intellectual. The universe changes not, because God is unchangeable, therefore what you begin to learn here in the rudiment, you will be certain to ascertain there in the ultimate life. What is germ here is flower there, and so you can trace upward all the consecutive and unbroken links by which germs reach onward to fruition, and thus bloom out naturally on the summits of the great trees of truth. Otherwise, that is, with a different notion, you have no philosophy and no science in your religion, only a dumb, slow, idiotic hedonism, blundering and stumbling headforemost into the absurdities of supernaturalism. Mystery and fear are what the olden ministers consider the best stock material in their stupendous trade. The high calling of every reformer is to make truth a simple unity and a sublime reality. We have science and philosophy beneath our feet, truth in our principles, and reason in our propositions, and nothing is true to our minds because any particular individual has said it, no authority to us in a thus saith the Lord. I appear before you to testify to celestial facts that came to me without a theory or a philosophy, without foregone conclusions, without any logical points to make out, or any favorite positions to affirm and maintain. If you can demonstrate my personal history in these particulars not to be real, publish it in your papers, and I will agree to pay you $100 for every line of such demonstration. The witnesses can nearly all be reached, and probably with the expense of from $2 to $5. These external remarks are for the lawyer and for the man who can't believe except he steps on solid ground. Therefore I say to such minds, try and see for yourselves whether these things be not as I have told you from the first. Prove these declarations to be utterly unfounded, and you shall be forever thanked by the sectarians of Christendom. After 10 years' acquaintance with the Cernma land, I made the inquiry, on one occasion, why it was that so many names of places there had Latin roots and Greek terminations. I had learned, on frequent interior occasions, to know what a Latin or Greek word meant, and how it was originated by scholars. By writing from the interior, I found that there is a kind of immortality in the Greek and Latin languages, more than there is in the Hebrew, the Arabic, and some other tongues more oriental and ancient. There is a great root vitality in some of what are called the dead languages. It seemed very curious to me that the Asiatic and Chaldaic languages were most represented in some of the spiritual brotherhoods, also the language spoken first on the American continent by the earliest inhabitants, by the Aborigines, and those more singular people who preceded them, that there are communities in the Summerland which really do continue to hold the words and memories of that language precious. And hence it may be remarked that the Shakers, when under their peculiar inspirations, the celestial afflatus which pervades a congregation of worshipping Shakers, speak fluently in what are called unknown tongues. Of course, on this point I need not stop to argue with and persuade Christians, because they have all read Paul, and know from such authority that such singular things used to be done, that all kinds of persons, in Pentecostal times, were uplifted and made to speak in unknown tongues, and it seems that the spiritual language of the Shakers is characteristic of the speech of certain brotherhoods in the Summerland, composed of minds who yet retain their first love for the words which characterized their nationality, in which all their national history and religious developments were written. They affectionately linger in it, and dwell in it, as bees in hives by the roadside. Why? Because human nature is human still, death not radically changing either the heart or head. There is, as I have before said, a beautiful mount called Starnose. A brotherhood of affiliated souls is seen upon the west of it, situated near a celestial pavilion called by the beautiful word, Canilium. This wondrously beautiful pavilion is not to shelter persons from the tempests and storms, as we design and use buildings on earth. There is no occasion to prepare for winter nor for great heat of summer. Different portions of the Summerland have different temperatures, but no such climate as we have in any part of the earth, because that land is made by the fine material contributions and gravitation of atoms of all planets in the solar system. Hence it is the product of many, and not of one, the earth being but one atomic contributor to the material formation of that existence. Only portions of that land, therefore, can retain the peculiarities of the earth, of which such portions are naturally more perfect representatives. This Canilium is a structure of exceeding beauty. It seems, to look at it, like a building made of trees, flowering shrubs, and countless vines. To the clairvoyant eye it is full of undescribable, beautiful colors. It seems to be composed of flowers that cast rays of lights and shadows like precious stones. And I wonder not that John, when standing on the Isle of Patmos and gazing into the upper sphere, seeing this marvelous pavilion, called it the New Jerusalem. Such gorgeous beauty, resplendent with what seems to be precious stones, is not often painted upon the upturned eyes of the clairvoyant. Flowing along this side of that beautiful pavilion is a river. I obtained the pronunciation of this word with great care, called a Petraveler. They sing to its tides. There is in that brotherhood a piece of music written to the life of the Petraveler. And there are times when the vast multi-arched Canilium throbs like a harp, responsive to the historical musical revelation of that beautiful celestial stream. Ali Ninico is the name of the Turk who is chief in that temple, still a follower and a believer in Mahomet. One would suppose that by this time he had outgrown his creed, but he has not. He often sees and adores the gifted man who represented Mecca. The dwellers in this temple still believe that the populations of other portions of the Summerland will yet take great interest in Mahomet, the prophet of God. Thus, Hinduism, as men call it, continues after death, and missionary workers, and even spiritualistic meetings, will be necessary in the upper land, because human nature is not supernatural, but continues to be human, outgrowing its errors either slowly or rapidly, in keeping with motives and temperaments. Some immediately improving and progressing in free truth, others remaining unimpressible and conservative for very long ages. Martillos is the young, bright wife of Ali Ninica. Martillos, who has lived centuries in that world, is mourning devotion, which is the significance of her name. She is filled with the spirit of the mastermind from whom they get their musical education. The doctrine of polygamy, which was so popular in Turkey and throughout all Mohammedan countries, is not practiced in this brotherhood. This beautiful girl seems to have been the savior of Ali Nainika. They constitute the central objects of talent and beauty, and are the host and hostess of that vast pavilion. In 1855, when I was writing something concerning that Christian sect which flourished in the second century, called their Gnostics, I realized a warmth and observed a little purple ray that was spread and trembling over the paper on which I was writing. It signified that there was some person present in spirit who would testify, and so, casting down my pen and yielding to that invitation, I received testimony from a man who called himself Iphlytus. He said that he was a scholar and a propagandist in that early sect. He remarked that the race of Gnostics is almost extinct, but that there are a few of them remaining, who still believe that they had the truth, and they accordingly continue to advocate it. Iphlytus himself lived in a very different section of the Summerland. Or, he said, gives the sound of a word which signifies the name of his lovely valley, the Iphlytus region, where, still a few Gnostics, like the Quakers of Earth, meet to exchange civilities and to hold social conferences or religious conversations. Is it strange that persons who go across the ocean into Europe should meet and talk over American affairs? Lo, it's strange that when the old man walks down into the twilight of his personal history, he loves to sit and tell over to younger persons what happened to him 80 years before? Always keep in remembrance that human nature is human, both in this world and in the Summerland. In the Valley of Ori, the oldest Gnostic, Iphlytus, holds his levees, and gathers about him those who wish to hear him tell of scenes and toils in Rome 17 centuries ago. They listen to the tales of a grandfather, and learn of the eventful century when Gnosticism first gathered its followers, when it grew, and became, for the time, a religious and local power. Zellerbingen is a vast German association, which was also seen in August, 1855. This association in the Summerland was located, when I first observed the assemblage, parallel with the rings of Saturn with reference to the path of the sun. That is, if you were at that moment a member of the Zellerbingen Association, and stood in its location, pointing northward at the time I mention, this way from the Summerland, you would have indicated a point in space directly, parallel to the situation and plane of the rings of the planet Saturn. To have pointed earthward would have nearly reversed the direction of your vision. This vast association is musical throughout. It is composed wholly of persons who had not, before death, acquired the power of song, but who yet possessed enthusiastic and ardent love for music, souls whose desires for song had not been gratified in the earth. Their Zellerbingen association is to them the glorious actualization of what here was ideal and perpetual disappointment. They each one said, I have now no voice for song, but I will yet sing, it is in me, I can silently sing, my spirit sings, and time will bring me song. How many German maidens, and how many German young men, have become members of the Zellerbingen Society. There they are, in the upper world, some of them centuries old, as our almanac would make it, yet younger than any grown person on earth. To them every morning is the beginning of a new day. By which I mean that every change in the cycle of their lives is to them the beginning of a new age through which they have never passed. They are fresh and new, spontaneous and beautiful. It was this Zellerbingen Society that first adopted the beautiful movement called the Children's Progressive Lyceum. They began, as we have, by the distribution of 12 groups. The groups were designated and regulated according to the ages of their members, that is to say, according to the ages of those who love music and song, and not according to ages kept by the almanac. For if you were measured and classified according to your spiritual age, you would, perhaps, be not more than 2 or 3 months in some things, others among you, though past life's meridian, are just born to a sight of spiritual things, and some of you, Although voters on election days are not yet born in wisdom and true faith, while others, years old in spiritual faith, are not a month old in matters pertaining to true knowledge. No, the soul is not to be measured by the almanac, but by its development from a state of darkness to a state of knowledge. In the Summerland there is no other account of time. A young man may, perhaps, know nothing of chemistry, but the same mind may be more than a century old in music. Youth is so perfect a principle in spirit that decay cannot come upon it. Every spirit, in the upper life, becomes a spontaneous spring of ever-recurring youthfulness. There's Elibingian society, I again observe, originally adopted the children's lyceum groups in the Summerland. The groups first represented notes of music. Then each group was an octave. At length the groups multiplied and numbered up higher and higher, until they constituted an orchestra with 1,000 octaves. The master spirits, standing among the musical groups, so that everyone could be reached, evoked such magnetic inspiration, that when a splendid piece of historical music rolled out from those accordant voices, the heavens seemed for the moment to be only music. It seems to me, when I first heard this celestial concert, that the people of Brooklyn, where I then resided, could not shut their ears against it. At the time I was in clairvoyance on the corner of Fulton and Franklin Avenues, in a room on the third floor, and it seemed that the busy inhabitants of New York, and all the cities round about, did certainly hear every note that was sounded. The lowest, the highest, and grandest notes were heard, and then the deep, deep bass, which seemed to come up from the profoundest starry depths, so that it seemed as though the harp of old ocean was attuned to perform a part of the melody. It seemed as though, had I had paper and pencil by me at the moment, I might have traced many parts of this wonderful historical music of the Elibingian society. But let us now speak of others. Lindenstein and Maransky are Russian and Austrian associations. The Lindenstein Association is more remote from the Elibingian Brotherhood than is England from America. It is situated very far away to the right. The Russian Association seemed to be immersed almost wholly in matters of history with reference to races of planets, no matter whether of this Earth or others in space. They have lost a great deal of their attachment to their native globe. They are peculiarly truthful, unselfish, and disinterested. They are almost Teutonic in their studious methods. They often associate themselves in large assemblies. And when I first saw them, on a particular occasion, it seemed to be their time of meeting. They were interested in, and debating upon, historical questions. The uses and lessons of such celestial conventions and deliberations will be seen at some future time. Maransky, the Austrian Assembly, or Society, is a very different brotherhood. They were, at that time, concerning themselves almost entirely with the formation of the best governments for the different tribes and peoples of the earth. They are politicians in their methods, but do not seek to exert political influence over kings and emperors. Monazalapu is the only exclusively African realm that I have ever seen in the spirit world. And here, for the first time, I saw the progeny of parents, of whatever race, not born perfectly organized in the formation of the inner brain, do not obtain an individualized representation after death. It seems that there was a very large percentage of the progeny of the early inhabitants who never attained to immortality. According to the testimony of the Monazalapu Association, myriads of the progeny of the semi-humans, who prevailed in the early ages of the globe, went down out of sight into the vortices and laboratories of matter. There was the no voice of lamentation. They said that their true children were not lost, for every human child naturally born is there, only those, who, taking on the shape of man, but not yet internally organized up to the human, were excluded from the upper spheres. 2 years previous, in 1853, I was led, by a very beautiful incident which I may not now relate, to see for the first time a brotherhood on the north of what I first called Mount Stanos, a beautiful Spanish association, more numerous than the population of America, called Acadlico, or Eco del Eco, the name as near as I can remember to pronounce. And there was round about that beautiful Starnosa lake that seemed to be of pure limpid amber. It was flowing, yet not heavily liquid as is our earthly water. It seemed to be more like flowing liquid atmosphere than like water, and it had the peculiar property of giving off a refreshing fragrance instead of a suffocating fog.